Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
They sent us to the ass end of the Kazakhstan steppe, a bleak, unforgiving stretch of wind-scoured land where rusted fences led nowhere and the horizon buzzed like a tuning fork. The wind still bit through 2 layers of thermals. The roads were barely roads at all, just tire-gouged scars in frozen soil. No birds, no herders, no villages, just empty land and silence for miles. When satellites fall, they're supposed to burn up in the atmosphere or land in the ocean, far away from anything that matters. That's how they're designed. But sometimes things go wrong. A miscalculation, a failed thruster, or a misfire in orbit. When they come down on land, it's our job to make it go away. We're contractors, a cleanup crew that log the telemetry, recover anything that didn't vaporize, and flag what might belong in a black box. Most of it's worth a slag by the time it hits Earth. Once or twice, we've pulled out something interesting, sensitive, usually gets taken off our hands before we can even ask what it was. This mission? Standard. 8 of us were assigned with 2 trucks, fold-out tents, portable uplinks, satellite relays, a drone, and a ground-penetrating radar unit. The site was flagged by orbital trackers. Something had come down hard and fast. We expected scorched wreckage, and a couple long days shoveling sand and mud. Maybe a bonus if anything survived intact. But something was off from the start. The telemetry was jittery. GPS would lock, then drift. The terrain didn't quite match the coordinates. It was like the maps themselves didn't want us here. And it was quiet. We got to work anyway. Carson, our team lead, oversaw the equipment setup. The techs calibrated the radar. I was helping drive rebar stakes when the beacon came through. It wasn't a dead ping. It was active. Short burst, compressed, repeating on a tight interval. Stronger than any beacon I'd heard on a recovery job. That got everyone's attention. Usually, those signals stop the moment the hull burns. But this one? It was transmitting. We thought maybe a hardened core had survived. Black box, guidance unit, who knows. But the signal didn't triangulate at surface level. We ran a GPR scan. The data came back clean. Beneath the topsoil, maybe 10 meters down, was a structure. Possibly a shattered hunk of metal. Not just scattered debris, but maybe a whole chunk of fuselage. "That's not possible," Carson muttered. The signal was coming from inside it. Whatever it was, it had survived orbital descent, impact, and burial. The surface showed the usual debris scatter, scorched paneling, shattered fins, a few fragments warped beyond recognition, all standard stuff for a satellite crash. But beneath that, buried deeper than expected, was something big. The techs figured it had to be a telemetry core or maybe a reinforced payload container, the kind that's designed to survive re-entry in case of failure. That would explain the signal too. Maybe it had been programmed to ping even after a crash to make recovery easier. Hell, maybe we'd get a salvage bonus. So we started plotting the dig. First, we measured soil density. Then we checked the frost layers and runoff paths. The permafrost was thick here. Excavating it would take time and precision, especially if we didn't want to crush whatever was buried beneath us. We'd be digging by hand, or close to it. Slow work. Then, mid-conversation, Jacob's radio flared up. A burst of static broke through his headset, followed by a strained, stuttering voice. "Is anyone up there? Hello? Please, I'm trapped. I don't know where I am." Everyone froze. We stared at Jacobs, then at each other. He looked as surprised as the rest of us. Carson took over immediately, checking the frequency. "Say again, identify yourself." A pause, then, "I can hear you. Please dig. It's dark. I'm alone. Help me." The blood drained from my face. That satellite wasn't manned. No satellite ever is. They don't send people up in those things. They're too small, fragile. That wasn't their purpose. Even the military ones are remote operated. There's no room for a cockpit, no reason for a crew. So who the hell was talking to us? We cycled frequencies, checked the relays. The signal wasn't bouncing from anywhere else. It wasn't interference. The origin point was right where the beacon was, 10 meters underground. We tried asking more questions. "Where are you from? How long have you been down there? What's your name?" But the voice never answered directly. It just kept begging. "Please, help me. Please dig. It's getting harder to breathe." At one point, it sobbed. It didn't ask who we were or ask how we'd found it. He just begged to be freed. Carson called it in. Protocol. Any anomaly, especially one involving unexpected transmissions, had to be logged immediately. We huddled around the portable satellite uplink, the signal cutting in and out as he explained the situation to the contact rep on the client's end, some mid-level handler for a private aerospace firm whose name I couldn't even pronounce. He kept it professional, calm, said the beacon was still active, that the internal casing might have survived impact, and then, almost like an afterthought, added, "There's been a voice on the radio. Claims someone's alive down there." The reply came back after a pause. A dry chuckle, then a sigh, like he'd just been asked the dumbest question in the world. "Yeah, no, that's not possible. The unit was unmanned. All of them are. You should know that." "We checked the source," Carson said. "The signal lines up with the buried object." The voice on the other end turned slightly sharp. "Radios bleed. You're hearing feedback. Crossover, maybe. Who knows what kind of interference you're getting out there?" "We asked it direct questions," Carson said. "It answered." "Well," the rep said, his tone already checked out. "Get the telemetry core. Tag the wreckage, file your report, leave the ghost stories out of it." The line went dead. We stood there for a while, just looking at each other. Nobody said it, but the unease had started to spread. If it had been static, we could have ignored it, or if it had been nonsense, we could have blamed the radios. But the voice was clear, panicked, and human. We tried to reason it out. Maybe it was bleed from another channel, or someone nearby using the same band. It could have been a prank, some ham operator screwing around. But that all of this was unlikely in the middle of nowhere. Carson finally broke the silence. "All right, we keep moving. We have a job to do. Officially, we're recovering materials. That's it." "And unofficially?" someone asked. Carson didn't answer, but everyone knew. Some of us wanted to get the job done and go home. The rest of us, we wanted to know who was down there. That night, the wind picked up. The temperature dropped hard and fast, like something had sunk its weight into the air. I sat in my bunk, trying to sleep. The low murmur of radios carried between tents like distant breathing. Then, mine lit up. Just for a second, a flash of static, a voice no louder than a whisper. "You heard me, didn't you?" By the next morning, the crew had started to split. Not outwardly, just subtle shifts in tone. People stood in small clumps now, muttering over breakfast, side-eyeing the radio set. Some of the team were convinced someone had to be alive down there. Had to be. They couldn't shake the voice, the cadence, the fear. It didn't sound artificial or like a recording. You don't fake the way someone chokes back a sob. But others weren't buying it. The rational ones, maybe. Or just the scared ones in disguise. They said it was interference, that even if it was real, even by some cosmic fluke a person had ended up inside that thing, there was no way they'd be alive after the fall. No food or oxygen on a satellite, no explanation could reasonably explain what we heard. Carson tried to keep things grounded. He was a by-the-books kind of guy, and by the book, we were here to recover orbital debris, not perform search and rescue missions for impossible voices. "Whether it's a person or a beacon," he told us flatly, "we're here to dig. Get to it." So we did. The GPR scans came back with more detail this time. The object wasn't just a dense cluster or some tangled core of junk metal. It had shape, defined edges, corners, symmetry. The technician squinted at the readout and said, half laughing, "Looks more like a room than a chunk of fuselage." Nobody laughed. Lucas started acting strangely, quieter than usual, twitchy. He was one of the older guys, wore his faith like a second skin, always had a rosary looped around his wrist, even when running cable. When the scan came through, he just stared at it, lips moving, but no sound coming out. Later, someone overheard him saying it wasn't a crash at all. "It's a demon," he muttered. When pressed, he shut down completely, wouldn't explain, just shook his head and returned to work, but slower now, twitchier, mumbling prayers under his breath whenever the radio crackled. That night, I couldn't sleep again. The wind had died, but the silence somehow felt louder than ever, like the world itself was on mute. As I passed Lucas's tent, I heard his voice, low and shaky. "Don't talk to it," he whispered. "Don't look at it. It's not stuck. It's waiting." The digging was slow. The ground didn't want to give. Even with the right tools, it felt like we were scratching at something that didn't want to be found. I took my break past the camp perimeter, just outside the flagged boundary. The air was sharper out there, more open. The quiet that makes you feel like you're being watched by the land itself. I was stretching my back when I heard it. A voice, low, muffled, careful. I followed the sound around one of the supply trailers, quiet as I could. That's when I saw Kyle, crouched behind the tires, hunched over a handheld shortwave radio. He was whispering into it, as if it were a lifeline. "I know, I miss you too. Soon, okay? I promise." He jumped the second I stepped around the corner and spotted me, fumbled the radio off like a kid caught smoking behind a gas station. "Jeez, man," he said too loud. "You scared the hell out of me." "Who are you talking to?" I asked. He gave me a crooked smile. "My wife. Missed our check-in last night. She gets anxious when I'm off-grid." I looked down at the radio. Shortwave. No satellite link. No repeater access. It wasn't even on the same band we were using. "You can't reach anyone on that," I said. He shrugged like it didn't matter and stood. "Guess I got lucky," he said. Then he walked off, casual, like it wasn't the creepiest thing I'd seen all day. That night, I couldn't sleep. Sometime past midnight, just as I was slipping between thoughts, the radio on the shelf above my bunk came to life. Just a soft click, like someone picking up a line they shouldn't have access to. Then a voice, calm, familiar, but not quite. "You're tired," it said. I sat up slowly, didn't answer. "You don't have to pretend. Not out here, not with me." There was something soothing in the cadence, like the voice of someone you'd known for years, softened by time. "I know what you've lost." I swallowed hard, but said nothing. The wind outside pushed against the tent in slow, steady pulses, like a heartbeat. "The pain you carry. I could take it from you." A pause, almost a breath. Not erase it, just hold it for a while, so you can sleep. So you don't have to keep walking up with your jaw clenched and your hands shaking. I never told anyone about the panic attacks, the insomnia. Not even Carson knew. I kept my personal out of the professional. "I don't want much," he whispered. "Just help me out." My hand hovered over the radio's power dial, but I didn't touch it. "You wouldn't be the first," it said softly, "and you won't be the last. But you listen better than the others." Then silence, like it knew it had said enough. By late afternoon, the soil had begun to shift. The upper layers were dry and crusted, but now we were hitting compacted earth, dense loam that cracked in slabs as we dug. The resistance had changed. It meant we were close. The GPR confirmed it. The full shape was now visible in the scans. A large object, maybe 10 meters long, half buried, one side jutting up like a broken tooth. It didn't look like any satellite component we'd ever pulled. It was too whole. We were close, but darkness was settling, which meant another night before we could fully uncover it. Dinner was quiet. Most of us were too frozen to talk. The wind had picked up again, blowing grit into every fold of clothing and crease of skin. Kyle, the one I caught whispering into the shortwave, was sitting near the mess tent entrance, grinning to himself. He looked like a man waiting for someone special to walk through the door. Every now and then, he'd glance toward the crater and smile, like he'd just remembered a private joke. Lucas didn't eat. He stood near the mess tent wall, arms folded, eyes down. He looked like someone trying not to throw up. That night, back in the bunk tent, I lay staring at the canvas ceiling while the wind rattled through the steel pipes. The day was starting to weigh on me, not just the fatigue in my body, but somewhere deeper. My thoughts kept circling around the voice, around the shape under the ground. I didn't know what I believed anymore. I was just starting to drift when I heard something. Boots, careful steps. I eased out of my cot and followed the sound through the flap. The night was moonless, only lit by the amber glow of the perimeter lamps. A figure moved along the edge of the excavation pit, hunched and deliberate. It was Lucas. I called out to him in a whisper, and he spun around, eyes wild. In his hands, he clutched something. At first, I thought it was a crowbar, but then I saw the edge, sharpened, improvised. "We can't leave it in there," he hissed. "We can't bring it out either. You understand?" I took a step closer. "What are you doing, man?" His hands were shaking. "They think it's talking to them. Maybe it is. But it lies. That's all it does." I looked at the weapon, then at his eyes. There was madness there, but also conviction. Stopping him would be dangerous. He was committed to this. "You really think it's dangerous?" I asked. He nodded slowly. "It's not a person. It's not trapped. It wants to be found. That's not the same thing." I looked at him for a long time, then said the only thing I could think to say. "Well, not my monkey, not my circus." He stared at me like he was trying to decide whether I was worth arguing with. Then he turned and walked off into the dark, down toward the edge of the crater. I didn't follow. I told myself I didn't care, and went back to bed. The morning felt off before we even reached the crater. Lucas was nowhere to be found. He hadn't returned to his bunk, hadn't shown for breakfast. I figured he was laying low, maybe hiding out in the equipment truck until things blew over, once we saw what he'd done. Or maybe he was ashamed. I wasn't the only one tense. When we arrived at the site, we all stopped short. The crater looked wrong. The soil we'd fought against for days was now loose, uneven. It looked freshly turned. The marks from our excavation, careful layers carved out with heavy tools, were gone, replaced by an uneven, sunken sprawl, like the earth had shifted overnight. No one spoke, until one of the new guys muttered, "Did a storm come through?" Another said, "No wind that strong last night." Carson didn't waste time on theories. "If it's loose, we'll count ourselves lucky," he said, slapping a glove against his thigh. "Let's get it done." We grabbed shovels and picks, no need for the power augers now. The ground peeled away like dry skin. Only a few minutes in, someone hit something solid. It wasn't just another scorched fragment or support strut. It was smooth, rounded, a faint gleam under the grit. We worked around it carefully, clearing layer by layer until the shape came into view. A long curve, then another. The lines connected, forming a capsule or pod, fused into the chunk of satellite fuselage we'd been chasing all along. Except, this didn't look like any satellite module we'd ever seen. The material caught light in strange ways, like it wasn't one surface, but several, folded into each other. Parts of it looked engineered, ribbed paneling, beveled edges, even what resembled cooling vents. But between those features were smooth, organic forms, soft iridescence beneath the grime, veined like tissue. You'd look at one corner and swear it was molded titanium, blink and it was cartilage. It was seamless. Almost. Then someone pointed it out. A faint line running along the side of the structure, about 4 feet long, thin as a wire shadow. A seam. "It's not latched," someone said, hushed. The air felt still. We didn't open it, not yet. We just stared. And for the first time, I realized we were all hoping. It was empty. No one spoke at first. We just stared at the seam like it might blink back. Eventually, Carson stepped forward, brushing the dirt from his gloves. "We're too far out to wait for anyone," he said. "We open it, log it, report what we find." I glanced at him. That wasn't true. We had uplinks, emergency priority channels. If this was truly alien, or even just anomalous, a dozen agencies will be salivating to send a team. But Carson didn't want oversight. He wanted to see what was inside. Maybe it was valuable. Maybe he just couldn't help himself. No one volunteered. Carson turned to us. "Someone?" he said, forcing casualness into his tone. "It's probably empty. Might not even open." But the air said different, and so did the silence. No one moved. It wasn't defiance, it wasn't consensus. None of us were opening that thing. If he wanted it open, he'd have to do it himself. His jaw flexed. I could see the calculation behind his eyes, how it would look if he didn't step up. He looked back at the pod, then down at the seam. Then he sighed, deep and shaky, like he was psyching himself up for a dive. "All right," he muttered. "I'll do it." We all backed up, fast. 10 feet, then 15. Nobody wanted to be near it when it opened. Even the ones who'd scoffed earlier were watching like it might explode. Carson stepped up to the pod with his shovel in hand, slid the edge into the seam, just enough to leverage. Dirt shifted off the surface, falling in slow trickles. The sun caught the damp sheen of the hull. He hesitated. Then, twisted. With a soft metal clunk, the hatch flicked open. Carson stumbled back, catching himself with the shovel. He didn't speak, just stared. Nothing came out. No smoke, no light, no movement. Just stillness. After a long moment, the rest of us edged closer until we could see what had stunned him. Lucas. His body was slumped inside the pod like it had grown around him. His limbs were twisted, broken in ways that didn't make sense. One arm was curled tight around his chest, the hand still clutching what looked like his makeshift weapon. No one spoke for a long time, confused by what this meant. Finally, I stepped forward. "I saw him last night," I said. My voice felt dry, foreign in my throat. "He was sneaking out, said he had to stop it, that we weren't taking it seriously." Someone asked what I meant. I hesitated, then told them everything. About Lucas's rant, his fear, how he believed whatever was inside was evil, that the thing he said right before walking off into the dark. It can lie. That's what it does. The silence was pure dread. Lucas had gone down thinking he could stop it. Maybe he thought it was a demon, or maybe he thought it was a test of faith. Either way, he tried to fight it and lost. But that wasn't what made my stomach drop. What made it worse was the realization we all arrived at, silently, almost in sync. Whatever had been trapped inside that pod was no longer there. It had escaped. every word it said to us, every promise, had been a lie to get out. And Kyle, who'd always been the most eager to dig, to defend it, to whisper into dead radios, now looked like the air had been sucked out of him. His mouth opened once, then again. "But it told me..." No one answered. Carson didn't even pretend to report what really happened. He stood a few paces from the pod, pale and shaking, and keyed the sat uplink. "The site is compromised," he said. "Unknown materials present, possible contamination or national security breach. I can't elaborate over comms. Request emergency response ASAP." He didn't mention Lucas or the voice. He didn't have to. You could hear it in his voice. Something was wrong, and it wasn't just debris. It took hours, but they came. At first, it was two men in plain black vehicles, no insignias, just questions. They arrived expecting radiation leaks or experimental tech. They left red-faced and calling in reinforcements. Then came the flood. Hazmat suits, drones, surveillance trucks, people flashing badges none of us recognized. Every agency you could name, and a few you couldn't. Just as one group claimed jurisdiction, another would come in and supersede them. The entire dig site turned into a battlefield of departments. Our camp was torn down and replaced with pop-up tents and gated perimeters. We were herded, interviewed, separated, re-interviewed. Some of us were interrogated. Some departments weren't sharing information, so we were made to tell the story dozens of times over. Only after exhaustive checks, psych evaluations, chemical swabs, hours of surveillance footage, did they seem to accept that we were just workers. We'd been caught in something much larger. They didn't thank us. They gave us papers to sign, heavy NDAs. We were told we'd be monitored indefinitely. Whatever we saw didn't happen. Lucas died in a ground collapse. There was no pod, no transmission, no voice. We were put on planes and sent home, one by one. I haven't seen Kyle since. Carson's number is disconnected. A few of the others still answer texts, but no one talks about what happened. And me? I moved, switched jobs, different name on the ID badge now. Still work remote sites, nothing satellite related. I thought if I kept moving, kept my head down, maybe I could forget. But sometimes, in the quiet hours just before sleep, I wonder, what was it? What had been locked in that pod, twisting its voice to match what we needed to hear? What had waited in the dirt, whispered promises, manipulated a team of hardened workers until it was free? And more than that, what now? Because it's out there, and it's spent a very, very long time learning how to lie.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.